land wants us to live differently here. Welcome to the last of 5 podcast interviews designed for the liturgical season of creation, recorded throughout the growing season of 2021. I'm your host, the Reverend Jonathan Crane, a priest in the Anglican Diocese of Edmonton. In this interview, I speak with Rick Dobish, a grain farmer near Warwick, Alberta. Rick grew up on the land he farms and, through his parents, remembers how much farming has changed in the last century. Reverend Chelsea Bowman and I traveled out to chat with him on a beautiful fall day, not long after he had pulled in his harvest for the year. We talk about the realities of being in the modern grain business, the changes in his community, and Rick's reflections of living on the land.
I thought we were going to play it back.
That's probably how easy it'll be.
That's it. So, welcome Rick to be with us. And we're focusing the podcast on people who have cared for a piece of land. And I'm also coming as someone who, you know, is from a city context. And I'm aware there's often a divide in understanding of people in a city context, in a rural context. We're part of the Anglican Diocese, which spans all of that. And so one of my goals for this is to kind of bridge that a little bit, you know, and get us thinking about land in a way that maybe we don't always think about. The basic thought is just to talk to people who spend their time caring for a piece of land and let that story unfold. So do you want to tell us a bit about what you do and the story of farming in your family? Because it's not just you, it started before you, if I'm correct.
Sure. I come from a family that's always lived on the farm. My parents were from farm families, so both of my grandparents' sides were also farm families, so it was just leaving the farm was quite a big change rather than to stay on the farm. It was maybe easier, maybe it was what everybody wanted to do. I knew right from when I was very young, that's what I wanted to do. So my parents didn't take over either of their parents' homestead, but once they got married, they did buy a homestead, someone else's homestead whose family was not going to continue farming, and it's grown since then. I was born in the local town and had a couple siblings, and we were all raised on the farm, and back then farming was it was a full life. It was chickens, pigs, milking cows, a few beef cows. It was, a full day of chores and a little bit of grain farming to go along with it. Whereas now it's changed, and many of the animal operations are quite large because the margins are so small and so tight that people need lots of numbers, and kind of the same with grain. In most cases, the grain farmers are specializing with just grain, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger, using more machinery and less labor.
So you've seen a real change over your life.
Well, my dad has passed, but when we had his 75th birthday, it was one of the things I said in my speech about him, is that he grew up, you know, walking in the fields behind horses to operating, you know, the biggest combine or tractor that John Deere built. So it was his lifetime saw such a drastic change. My lifetime already, it's no lies, the technology has advanced us huge leaps and bounds, but I would say that his generation really went through a dramatic industrialization change, whereas my generation is more technology with improved genetics and things like computer-aided management of the farm or of the equipment. The equipment can drive itself, be very much more efficient, not double up on spraying or seeding, to limit, you know, the use of pesticides and fertilizer, cut your fuel costs because you're not overlapping and using human judgment or human error. It's all done by a computer now in most cases.
Do you remember what he thought about that? Like, what was that for him? What did he say about that change in his life?
My dad was quite progressive. And when I started farming with him, back then it was, you had two or three tractors and men, and you would cultivate the land and disc the land and work the land again and then seed the land in it. And it's just the way things were done, and people made summer fallow where they didn't grow a crop for a year. And that was the old-fashioned, high mechanization way of doing things. And when we started farming, there was a lot of drier years, and we adopted, because of me, that was my contribution, that we moved into zero tilling and low minimum seeding and all these new type of technologies that saved moisture, saved fuel, reduced our carbon footprint, and really saved the farming industry in Alberta because I think the 90s and the 2000s were so dry that if we would have farmed like our grandfathers farmed, we would have had another similar to the dirty 30s. It would have been very, very poor crops because when you work it, you release carbon into the air, you waste the moisture. Here you can just seed right into the last year's crop. Mm. And the soil is actually, we're building the soil now rather than mining the soil like they used to. So I think that technological advantage was a huge thing that's, I think, not recognized by the average person or even by governments, in our tax system. It's a bit frustrating.
I've only just heard of zero-till recently. Like, I don't know, how common is that for?
Well, it's very common. Some people might maybe minimum till, where they might work a field once and then seed into it, but very common. And I would hate to guess because I have no real idea of the percentage, but a high percentage of the acres are just seeded directly into last year's residue. So I mean, you have a narrow opener, like a knife type opener, which doesn't disturb a lot of land and just puts the seed and the fertilizer, you know, down in the ground in a two inch deep or 3 inch deep trench type of, you know, just trying to picture it or make it a picture, and they're let's say a foot apart, so that maybe disturbs an inch or 3/4 of an inch of soil, and then you have 10 inches of undisturbed soil, and then another disturbance where you have seed. So like when you go to crop harvest last year's crop, or when this year's crop starts coming up, it's coming up, these little green rows are coming up through the residue, the dry straw from last year. So it keeps, like when the wind blows, the soil, if you use that type of a system, the soil doesn't move, doesn't drift away, doesn't blow, which is erosion and is a huge, I recall just one, it's hard to fathom, like how do you put something, like I think the soil, when that technology came out, they would say like in one drift event, one bad windstorm during a day on summer fall, if you think you lost, let's say the thickness of a dime blew away, that was like the equivalent like of 10 tons an acre, which would be like on a 150-acre quarter section or 160-acre quarter section, theoretically. That would be 100 truckloads of dirt that someone came to your farm and hauled away. Would you ever allow that? But yet the way they used to farm, they didn't, you know, they just didn't understand that it was so drastic.
Once it's dry and you turn it up,
it's gone. Loose. It's, yeah, and if you get these, you know, it would have to be a severe wind, but it can happen. And we do see, and it still is a problem where you have hilltops that have less topsoil, thickness of topsoil on them, because over the 30s and 40s and 50s, when they used to farm the old way, those hilltops were eroded and And erosion still does happen when drastic rainstorms or maybe even in a windstorm, but we're trying to limit that, to minimize all that type of an incident and protect our soil, because the soil is what we count on. We're trying to, the more vibrant our soil is, whether it's organic matter and bacteria and earthworms and all those alive organisms, that makes for a healthy ecosystem, and our crops do better just naturally, that we want to protect that. It's in our best interest. We don't want to mine it and use it if we're the owners and the caretakers of that land. We want to leave it to the next generation. If our kids are going to farm or our neighbor's kids are going to farm, that's all.
Your family lives with you on the land here. Do they help out in the farm, or is it still mainly yours?
Yeah, see, that's, we have, you always have, when things are over, you sort of have regrets. Like when our kids were young, when I was young, it was a big deal to go to town. It was, there was not much of that playing after school sports or whatever, because you didn't have a ride home. If you didn't come home on the bus, there was no one coming in to pick you up. It got better and better as, you know, when I was in high school already, or when my siblings were older, things, I guess like with every family, they sort of get easier as the family, you know, gets older and more affluent or well off, or not well off, but just less things to do. And so that was something that I really focused on my kids, that I wanted them to play all the sports they could. And they never really were strapped. They helped on the farm when they were younger, but by then already we were sort of mostly out of livestock. We never really had a lot of chores to do, you know, cutting grass and stuff like that. A little bit of field work. When I was young, it was common for you to maybe start and start driving equipment when you were 12 or 14 years old, or maybe in some families even younger, because they just needed the help. Nowadays, well, you shriek like, or say, well, I'm not going to let a 16-year, you know, you got to be 16-year-olds old, or you, maybe a 14-year-old's cutting grass, but a 14-year-old's not out running a combine or driving a truck in the field or something like that. Like, we're much more, I would say, what you would say determine now is more responsible, and our standards are much higher or controlled, where we wouldn't, I think, back in the day. And I'm not saying that it was all about that only agriculture was like that. I'm sure everybody our generation learned to drive when they were just barely could reach the pedals. But as of now, we do have one son living at home with us. He's an engineer and he's working remotely, but he is he's raising a family on the farm, and he is contributing after hours and on weekends.
Keeps you close to the grandkids.
And yes, our only grandchildren so far. So it's really been a pleasure these last couple of years.
That's another kind of growth in production, you know.
Well, yeah, I don't know. They just moved home from Germany a year ago. So I think for the grandkids to be on a farm and to see machinery and go for rides, and got an electric quad and they're driving around, riding the quad and all those things, right? Like, just a much more earthly, and pets, anything you can, and space. Like, we just have, you know, our yard is acres and acres big. Like, there's so much room and it's so quiet, and you basically have the greatest lifestyle I think you could ever want.
Chelsea was saying you do quite a bit of gardening. Pumpkins and...
Well, some this year got really carried away. Our pumpkin patch yielded over 450 pumpkins to the... We grow a patch for Valid, which is a Beggarville Association for Living in Dignity. It's like they house and take care of handicapped people and get them jobs and sort of... So it's a fundraiser for them. The pumpkins, they go around and they sell them, and they don't, you know, give out the pumpkins for donations and whatever. It's a big deal. So we have been growing pumpkins for them for years, but this year we expanded the patch a little bit. With the dry year, we watered it out of our dugout, and it just yielded a bumper crop of pumpkins. And we had a really nice stand of corn this year. It was so warm, the corn did really well. My wife's a little bit gone crazy with sunflowers. We've got sunflowers around the yard.
They're massive.
Yeah, I think some of them are some kind of Russian giants or something. They're 12 feet tall. But it's interesting, and it's fun. It gives you something to do during the summer when you don't go golfing. You're out watering the garden.
How is the growing season this year?
Well, the growing, we're northeastern Alberta. We're dryland farmers. No irrigation anywhere but in the far south. And it was very hot and below, very much below average rainfall. And we, in most cases, I would say most people grew a little bit better than half a crop what they usually grow, half the yield, maybe. Really? Like maybe 60%, maybe even less than half of what they have been growing in the last 5 to 10 years. So really, not a disaster, but close to a disaster. The cattle farmers have no feed or very low volume of feed, and stressful. We hear the prices are very good now, but if you don't have the crop to sell, it really doesn't matter what the prices are. So kind of always farmers were price takers. We don't really dictate what the prices are going to be. Like the world commodity prices are internationally traded, and it works back to the farm gate, right? If there's more costs or delays in shipping or arbitrage with ships waiting to load or rail strikes or whatever, it always sort of stops at the farm gate. Those things always come back to us. Any kind of price increases. Grain prices are great this year. Fertilizer prices doubled because of storms and things going on with energy, and chemicals are up, and it just goes on and on, right? It doesn't really ever stop. Anytime you think you got a little bit extra, someone else wants to take it away from you.
How is that for you to live in that year to year?
Well, it can be stressful at times. I mean, it's hard. Well, my wife wasn't a farm girl, so when she initially started here, you know, she couldn't understand that you put out all this money and what, you don't get a paycheck till when? Till the crop is in, right? Like, I mean, it's a, you know, you work all year and then you have sort of a big payday, you hope, or a return on your investment and all your hard work. And if Mother Nature cooperates, it's, you know, it's most cases, like with the technology and with how we manage things, every business is, in every kind of business, there are businesses that struggle, right? Like whether it's, it can get quite stressful, right? You work up a big bill or a debt with your local suppliers, and then in harvest, after harvest, there's a big push to sell some grain and get those bills paid up. And if you have some mortgages, you want to make payments. And then at the end, you hope, well, I hope there's enough left over, you know?
Enough for Christmas.
You know? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I mean, it's not. It's all good. I would never, you know, farmers always like to complain about not enough rain, too much rain, grain prices too cheap, fuel too high, whatever. I mean, but it's human nature. I'd like things to be different, but I think they're, you know, I'm happy with my choices.
Yeah. You're smiling as you talk about it. So,
yeah.
You know, that's a good sign to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a significant piece of waiting through the whole year for payday, as you say. Do you think of yourself almost more as a businessman in that, or is the first line farming? That's just,
yeah, well, it has to be a business. I mean, if you want to keep farming, you have to survive. You have to make money, enough money to keep going. And it's like any business. They say if you're not growing, you're dying, right? Whether you're building equity or expanding or improving something, you're at least, you know, think you're making some sort of progress. I would say that business, like, or the farm business has become much more of a business than it used to be. Our risk is many, many times higher. Our inputs are hundreds of dollars an acre rather than tens of dollars an acre. And It shows up in land rent and capitalization and of land prices. I think, you know, when my parents were here, you know, they had five or six close neighbors. They always helped each other. All winter was playing cards. Nobody went anywhere. There wasn't very much TV to watch, maybe Bonanza and hockey games. And everybody, you know, they were playing cards and games, if not every day of the week, you know, at least it's your turn to come here. And then there's lunch and coffee and snacks. And it's hard. It's not a whole lot of that anymore. Like, I mean, we still have a couple close neighbors that we're, you know, friendly with and play, try to get together. But at the same time, the farms are much further apart and much bigger, right? There's just less of us out here. So, you know, we're back in the day, if you had a farm on every quarter, they were much, or every homestead, every half section, you know, they were just very much more populated. And that all shows up in the small towns and the businesses in the small towns. Just less and less people to support those businesses. And now we're so much more mobile. It's nothing to drive an hour to get to Sherwood Park or the city to find something that you can't find in Vegreville. But then it's hard on Vegreville to, for if everybody starts doing that, then what can you carry and support in Vegreville if everybody's going to the city? You know, there's good grocery stores. It's basic a retirement town. It's basically a farm implement town where there's, but it's really hard, you know, let's say for ladies wear or, you know, I'd say back in the day, I remember there used to be clothing stores when I was young. Even worked at, you know, friends that worked at one, right, or whatever. And it's very limited now, right, that just don't see those type of stores much anymore. You know, a Mark's Warehouse, well, what did they carry? Sweats and jeans and T-shirts, right, or winter wear, but nothing like, used to be able to buy a suit in Vegreville, right? I mean, it's quite different. And there are small towns, businesses are struggling, I think, just as much because of the reduction in population.
Thinking of that, what's often a divide, urban, rural, what would you like someone like myself living in the city or anybody living in Edmonton, living in a bigger center, what is it that you would like them to know about your life here, or to know about the life of farming that maybe you've heard sort of some misconceptions?
Well, I think for everyone to know how food gets to the grocery store and where it comes from. Like, you know, a lot of our vegetables and whatnot in the off season is all imported, but we do have a lot of vegetables grown in the local area during the summertime. And grain, I mean, we're grain farmers, and Canada with its population, we don't consume very much grain because of our population. We just can't. So we're Canadian farmers are big exporters. I mean, the grain industry and the cattle industry, we're a big contributor to the GDP in the prairie provinces. And but I think just generally that people, you know, misconceptions where, or one big one is organic is better. It's maybe different, but it's not necessarily better. And most cases, our use of farm chemicals and herbicides have been greatly reduced, and the chemicals we use are much less harmful than the way what they used to be. In the, you know, so just in generally, like any, well, another big thing is with climate change. Well, fertilizer, it takes energy and whatnot to produce, and all these things. It's a very complex system, but the farmers are doing everything they can with direct seeding and newer equipment. The equipment's all, you know, up to speed with the, like I said before, the computer alignments. You don't overlap. The engines are all tier four now. You know, they're just like the automobiles. They have to improve and reduce their harmful emissions. So as an industry, we're all, you know, doing our the most we can and the our part to participate to keep things, you know, keep this world alive or whatever. I mean, the first thing and the worst thing that could happen is if the world is short of food. And if we all went organic, I mean, there would be just a drastic reduction in production. And we have to compete with the world. Like, we're a high-cost producer. Now we see South America and even the States, they just have different weather and they just have a much, especially in South America, I mean, they're bringing lots of acres into production. They're drastically bigger and bigger players in the world market. And, you know, a lot of everything is so costly to us too, right? Like to get a product to the coast, you know, the transportation is such a big cost to us.
Do you know where your grain ends up?
Not specifically. That's something that, you know, maybe there's probably some guys that maybe do, or if you sell a specialty item, like you might be able to track that. But in most cases, like your mainstream general crops, whether it's oats or barley, or I mean, you could sell barley to a local consumer, whether it be a brewery or a maltster or a feedlot. But I'm saying that most cases, the grain goes to a line company. You know, there's four or five major players. They charge us for elevating and loading. They buy the grain from us and they sell the grain. So we don't really know who they're selling it to, because they'll maybe buy 100,000 tons of wheat from a bunch of farmers. You know, and that could be from all over Western Canada, because each company pools their grain into their terminal on the coast and they'll load it on a boat, you know, to go to China or the Middle East or wherever they've made a sale. And, you know, it could be, there's bigger vessels, smaller vessels. It could be a combination of products going into one vessel. But the companies themselves are doing that. We don't really get involved in that. And it's quite a very risky thing. Whereas if you would make a direct sale, let's say load a container and sell it to somebody in another country, would you ever get paid? I mean, it's just much simpler, bigger volumes. I mean, that would be a small niche specialty item where you would do something like that, I guess. And you'd have to really not versed in that. I mean, you know, to have the connections, get the bonding, you know, so that you know you'd be secure and whatnot. Here you drive up, you know, whether it's 20 or 50 miles to your local elevator, dump your load, and I mean, you can get a check if you're happy with the price they're paying. And they all work off the futures. They all have their different bases. So you, any day you can phone five elevators and get five different prices for the same load of grain. So you have to shop it around. You have to market it.
Kind of the opposite of gassing up your truck. You know, you're shopping around for the best deal. And
right.
Yeah. Here you're unloading.
Right. But similar. You're still shopping around for the best deal. You're in gas, you want the cheapest price. Here we're trying to get the best price.
That's right.
Or the closest to haul, or, you know, the best delivery. I want to deliver tomorrow. Well, no, we're not taking that kind of grain tomorrow. We're not taking it for 2 weeks. So if you want to sell some grain, you might have to deliver somewhere else. Or now they load like 120, 128, 132 cars at once. And usually that train, in most cases, made up of one type of grain. I mean, on occasion, they won't have that grain, so maybe they'll, you know, have two or three products in there. But that's all. There's big bonuses from the rail companies to the grain companies when they do that, because it's simpler. They come in and they pull a hookup to 100 cars, 128 cars, whatever the number is. At each elevator is different, but every time they build a new elevator, that spot gets bigger. And now it's up to 128 or 132 cars. They made the newer cars a little bit shorter, a little bit higher. They get the same weight in a smaller. They can put a couple more cars in the same length of train. It's all about efficiency, because it costs so much to get that grain to the coast. If you ever saw, now they have an elevator would be built with, let's say, four sections where they can set 25 cars, and they'll load those 25 cars. Now they'll build a big loop where they leave those 128 cars hooked up, or 32, or whatever it is, whatever the number is, hooked up. And they'll just, that thing just goes in a loop. And then when the locomotive comes back, he just hooks onto that loaded train and takes off. Because every time they unhook the train, they have to air it up, and that takes hours. And just all efficient, efficient, efficient. Like every time they try and do something, it's more efficient.
And we drove past that on their way here, didn't we?
On 631 and the one just east of town.
Right, yeah.
Those are both new elevators that were built in the last number of years, and they both have what they call a loop track.
Yeah.
So they basically take up, I don't know if it's 80 acres or 100 acres to build this loop track. And, it's all to be efficiency, so. And those big elevators look big, but when they load a train that big, they usually only can store one or two and a half times trains at once. So when a bunch of farmers start hauling, you know, they might be empty, and in a few days they're plugged. They're full till the next train comes. And they'll get a train for, let's say, wheat. Or they know what the next train coming for. So the weeks or months before that train gets here, they have to plan. They say, okay, we're getting a train on October 1st for hard red wheat. So those weeks before that, they want to buy that kind of wheat. They don't want to buy barley or peas or canola and fill up their elevator with stuff that can't go in that train. They have to buy the proper stuff because they've got orders. That train has to get loaded with that product because that product has to get to go to the terminal to get unloaded so that there's that type of grain to load the boat. So it has to work its way back into the system. So it's all, that's all their part. They got to manage that. But when we go to haul, we say, well, I want to haul canola today because I need to pay my fertilizer bill or my gas bill. Well, we're not taking canola for a month or 2 weeks or whatever. We're, you know, it's kind of like there's a little bit of that you have to work your way around. And even traditionally, I would say most farmers, when you're seeding your crop, or even before you seed your crop, you might sell 10% of what you think you're going to grow, whether it's wheat or canola or barley. And as the crop comes up, maybe you'll sell a little bit more. And then in the middle of June, the crop looks like it's doing well. You'll sell, and what do you want to call that, an incremental sale? So you're sort of spreading your, traditionally when you combines start going in August or September, there's a bunch of grain available and the price will generally, if it's a normal year, go down. So you want to try and capture as your marketing, as a producer, they'll say, well, you know, the price is 50 cents higher than in May or April or something, or even January for next fall. Well, maybe I'm going to sell a few bushels, a few percent of what I'm going to grow, planning to grow. You have sort of you have a rotation. You grow wheat on, you know, maybe a cereal, then a broadleaf, which would be your canola, and then maybe a wheat, and then maybe a barley. So you kind of have a schedule of what your acres are going to be unless you change something.
Is that through the year? Like you're growing different things through the year on the
same?
Well,
year to year. Acre would have wheat on it this year. Next year it'll have maybe barley. And then maybe you'll go to, depending on your year-to-year rotation, some people might grow wheat, canola. Some people will grow wheat, barley, canola. Some people will grow wheat, canola, oats, wheat or whatever, something like that. Or peas, there's peas in that rotation. Some flax, but we get the main crops are canola and wheat, and then as you go down, the percentages in acres get less because some guys just aren't growing those crops for simplicity's sake or whatever. Maybe you grow two or three different kinds of wheat or whatever. You'll grow those. You'll say, I have 3,000 acres or 300 acres, doesn't matter, but 1,000 of each crop. So I'm in spring, I'm going to start seeding. Not seeding, sorry. Marketing a few percent of each of those acres. Because I think, if I think that cost, what I can sell at is maybe above my cost of production, what I think, and your cost of production is based on what you think your inputs are going to be and your, you know, mortgages and whatnot, you sort of know that an expected yield, you know, your average yield over the years, maybe use that for your budget and an average price, and you hope for a better yield and maybe try and market into above average price to generate more than a break-even profit line, right? We increase your margins because that's all we can do. Try and grow more and try and sell it higher. Mm-hmm. in most cases, the selling hire is, I mean, it's very important to be a good marketer, but, you know, in general, historic times, that prices don't fluctuate unless what we're seeing now is we're in uncharted territory for prices. Doesn't happen because of poor crops. But when there's a normal crop, normal volumes, the prices are normal, average. And you can predict that. And now, you know, if we get a normal year, we're going to grow whatever it is, you know, 50 bushels or something. But then if we get a little bit extra rain or something happens that we grow 60 bushels, well, then that few extra bushels are all added to our profit line, to our margin. Whereas those first bushels we know are just going to break, you know, be part of our budget.
The logistics are mind-boggling. How all of this fits together and your livelihood and seasonal structures, and I can't think of many other jobs that have that kind of cycle.
I guess it sounds, and even when I talk to my son now at home, he keeps asking these type of hard to answer questions, and sometimes it's hard to answer because you've grown up sort of doing it and developing your system and grown into that. And he says, well, how do you decide? Well, I don't know. I just make that decision, right? Whether you choose what brand or what variety of a crop to seed because you want to follow that system, or you want to, maybe you like those genetics, mm-hmm. or you're targeting a certain market.
Because you're also choosing the seed that you're using.
Well, especially something like canola. If there's not 50, if there's not 100, there's at least 50 varieties out there. Like, there's just oodles of companies. There's the mainstream companies that have the market share, but there's all kinds of companies that have seed, and every few years they come up with a new seed, you know, like numbers of seed. Like, each company will have maybe 5 or 10 varieties, and then as they get a little bit older, these get dropped off, and the new ones, every year or 2 years, they're introducing new ones. You got to keep following the genetics, following the yields.
Do you have a favorite time of the year?
Harvest. It's a beautiful time of the year. It's busy, but it's also quite rewarding. And it seems like when you take that crop off, it's such a big drastic change. You can really see what you did. We do so much straight cutting now. So you come to a field and it's full of crop standing. And when you're done, it's just shaved, like cut. It's just such a drastic difference. And it's the fruit of your labor, so it's very rewarding.
I'm glad we got a chance to connect with you. And just after harvest season, I'm sure it's been pretty busy.
It's been a great harvest, though. It's dry, and we hope our trees don't die and our grasses.
And I want to thank Chelsea, who is the canon for a rural ministry, for setting this up and connecting us with you. Thank you, Rick.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it. I was a little leery, but I enjoyed it.
Really good to hear. A lot I didn't know in that, so thank you.
Good. I'm glad I instilled some insight or whatever, you know, but I like it.
I hope this interview has given you a few new thoughts to consider on how food reaches your plate, of how farming happens in Alberta. Farming is a life reality that so few of us are really connected to, and I'm thankful for people like Rick who can help us connect our world a little bit more. The music used in this podcast is by permission from the work of local musician Aaron Parker. Thank you for listening. May we truly come to know how the land wishes us to live here.